Welcome to The Hoop Commitment. I'm your host, Mike Nielsen. Join me every week to get inside the greatest minds in basketball nutrition, training, and leadership to elevate your game and improve the way you eat, train, and lead. Welcome to episode 83. Now, I've got a special interview today for all you sports lovers. Greg Bishop is a senior sports writer for Sports Illustrated, and we became friends when he was doing research for his Gonzaga cover stories. Now, I'm usually a little nervous before every interview, but this one was definitely more intense because I was asking questions to a guy that interviews people for a living. He's unbelievable at finding the story within the story, and so I was feeling pretty insecure with my ability to host a conversation and dig deeper. But of course, I got on the phone with him, and he made me feel right at home. And the reason I wanted to connect with Greg is because he gets to look behind the curtain of the most successful sport programs and athletes in the world. His feature subjects have ranged from Ricky Williams to Adrian Peterson to Aaron Rodgers and to, of course, my Gonzaga Bulldogs. He spent time as a Jets beat writer for the New York Times and the Seahawks beat writer for the Seattle Times. And today I picked his brain on the common threads he's noticed with the most famous players in the world and how the greatest have handled their success and how the average person can learn from them. Here's Greg Bishop. Greg, welcome to the Hoop Commitment Podcast. How you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's going to be a fun day and really fun for me. The pressure's on because you're normally the pro at interviewing people. So now the shoe's on the other foot. And one of the things you get to do is you get to interview and connect with the most successful athletes and coaches in the world. So I'm excited to pick your brain. But before that, I want to find out, how does one become a sports writer?
Yeah, it's kind of an odd profession. Like, my friends always tell me, like, I can't complain about my job, because to them, it's just, you know, going to games and talking to people that they like to watch on TV and stuff like that. You know, I kind of fell into it. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington. I went to Syracuse for college. I'd never been on a plane before I went to Syracuse, which is pretty crazy when you think about my life now. And, you know, essentially I wanted to study finance and journalism, but I sort of fell in love with covering the teams at Syracuse. When you're a part of the sports staff, you cover basketball, football, and lacrosse, which is obviously huge on the East Coast. And I got to see these guys were going, you know, to travel to all these games. You know, they got to go with the basketball team to the Sweet 16. They got to, you know, write about the athletes that were prominent on campus. And that life sort of really appealed to me. You know, the sort of final piece is that I'm not the typical sports writer in that, like, I don't sit around watching games every night. My wife would never permit that, you know, anyway. But I love the freedom that I get in sports writing. To me, it's every section of the paper put into one place. So you're writing about business, you're writing about money, you're writing about power, you're writing about fame and celebrity. And ultimately, what I think I've found myself most drawn to, like, it wasn't really intentional, is what motivates people, you know, what makes them sort of, what drives them to do what they do. And I always think that the best way to tell a story is the first step is what, the second step is how. My stories, I hope, tell you why, because that's what did a person do that made, you know, why, what drove them to do this thing? What drove Mark Few to build a basketball power in Spokane, in the last place you'd ever think? And so, you know, to me, that's like what I love about sports writing in a nutshell. It's not even sports. It's the human beings that are pursuing these things and what drove them to do that specifically.
Well, let's talk about that process. So you mentioned the first thing is the what. And is that something that your editor is telling you, this is the what you're going to go check into? Or is this stuff that you're finding out?
For me, I like to come up with most of my own ideas to keep it out of their hands. Occasionally I get an assignment. I just got back from Los Angeles last night. I spent 420 with Ricky Williams. So that was something where I've written about him before. My editors say, go get on a plane and knock it out and go. But most times though, I am specifically looking for ideas. I do that by reading a lot. I do it by watching a ton of television. And I basically, over the 21 years I've been doing this, you know, have taught myself to think in narrative arc. So when I'm at the dentist, I'm thinking about a story. When I'm out with my friends, I'm thinking about a story. And I like can't shut it off anymore. I've created a monster. And so I'm always pinging my editors at, like, you know, late at night or early in the morning saying, this would make a great piece. And what's interesting in light of Gonzaga in regard to that process is, like, I've always covered them during the tournament. I've written about them for the New York Times when I was there. and I've just done a lot of stuff on them. But this year, because of COVID, I sat down and watched a ton of their games. I just said that I don't watch a lot of sports on TV, but I did get into college basketball this season specifically. And about like 5 or 6 games into watching them, I said, holy cow, there is a story here. Like, this is not the Gonzaga that I remember in 17. It's not 100 centers plotting down the court. Like, this is a fascinating style of basketball. And that's what drew me to pitch that as a story, which, you know, led to Barry helping me out to do it and everybody calling, which ultimately led to our first college basketball cover in a long time. And so that's the goal, is that like, I'm just doing something that I would do anyway. And something pops into my head like, oh, that's a great story. And then, you know, off I go. That's pretty much the job in a nutshell.
And so that's maybe how you find the how. How are you digging in and discovering the why? So you mentioned the Gonzaga basketball program. I love that cover, by the way. That I'm a little bit biased, but that was one of the coolest covers I've seen. How did you dig and where did you find the stories in that piece?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, to me, like, what I really wanted to avoid was sort of the typical narrative you get about Gonzaga. And I do know that as someone who's based on the West Coast, I live outside Seattle. You know, I do think there is some relevance to like that we get lazy in my business, that the idea is Gonzaga is a Cinderella. It's from a town that's not that big. You know, it's all these wheat fields, blah, blah, blah. And like, as you know, Mike, none of that's true. You know, Spokane's a big city. You know, it's like a real legitimate place. And, you know, Mark and them disposed of that sort of notion of Cinderella to me back in 2013. And so, you know, what I wanted to do was get beyond that. You know, to me, I saw Suggs as sort of a centerpiece, Jalen Suggs, to getting beyond that. To me, he typified the evolution. You know, here's a guy that could have been the number one pick in the draft coming up, that was a top recruit in the country, that didn't want to play football at Ohio State. Gonzaga has always had good players, but to me, this was like a level beyond that. And it spoke to the evolution in a way that I thought was cool. You know, this is a major program becoming something better than that, which is, you know, that doesn't happen very often. This is the comparison I kept coming back to, is Notre Dame football. You know, we think of Notre Dame football as this behemoth, this like great, amazing thing. What we forget is that like it wasn't. It was just a small town in Indiana where the school was built, and it happened to grow this incredible tradition that we now take for granted. So I went in like kind of lobbing that premise. I asked Mark Few about it. I asked Mike Roth about it. I asked Tommy Lloyd about it. I asked the players about it. The players were the most fascinating because they've never seen Gonzaga in that light. You know, they only know the power. And so they were, Joel Ayayi was like kind of laughing. Like, you know, you think that I picked this like small place. Like, dude, all I know from Gonzaga is they go to the Sweet 16 every year. You know, and like, so that spoke to me like, okay, like how can we build in the backstory in a way that makes sense, you know? And so then it's like diving into how do they grow, you know? It's the international recruiting. It's the development of players. It's getting great players that didn't play as well together as they'd hoped. You know, Travis Knight to me is a guy that's often overlooked nationally that has had a massive impact on that program. So I really wanted to unspool how does he do things, you know? So that led to Personal Growth Mondays. That led to the speakers he brings in. That led to how Wichita State for him changed how they should approach these seasons. And then obviously there's the history, you know, guys like yourself, Matt Santangelo, Casey Calvary, another Tacoma guy after my own heart. And I wanted to really trace what it was like for them to watch this. You know, did they buy my premise? Is this Notre Dame football? And, you know, some really cool stuff came out of that. Casey ended up connecting with me with Mike Chrysler, who like can't believe the resources that are involved now when you guys were pulling trucks, you know, like with players standing in the back for extra weight. You know, to me, Tommy became a pretty central figure in that story because to me, he embodied a lot of what's been built. I know since then things have changed, you know, and then you look at like how the roster was put together. You have this French swingman who's leading the team in the rebounding at the time. You have a tall guy from Texas who's the best passer maybe in college hoops. And then you have, you know, Andrew Nembhard transferring in, perfect piece. And so my goal, which at the time I think my editors found a little overambitious, was to tie that together. How did we get here? What does it say about Mark? Why is this team different? And how does that speak to everything else? And so when you add all that together, you mentioned the cover. To me, it was perfect, you know, the program, because that's what it is. It is something, there will be a 30 for 30 on this someday. To me, this is like where we're building toward the best ending to that documentary.
So many schools, coaches want what Gonzaga has now. And the way you just described it in the last 5 minutes, it's not just do this one thing or do these two things. You mentioned 10 things. out of that, as you're digging through and you're finding out what makes Gonzaga, Gonzaga, what are you thinking? How could another school start to even replicate or be able to move in this direction?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, in 2013, I went to Spokane when I was living in New York and writing for the Times. And I wrote essentially, stop calling them a mid-major. You know, this was the first number one overall ranking, first number one overall seed. And it was basically like, look, I think I led the story with Mark's office, which is just like a, there's so many trophies, they're like sitting askew. You know, it's like, you know, the way that you and I would leave a sock around, he's got like a WCC trophy just like off in the corner gathering dust. And like, you know, to me, that image really spoke to a program that had built this thing that people needed to just appreciate, which is a thing of Mark's, I think, forever. This isn't easy, what we did. Learn to love it because it may never happen again. Now, in that story, I talked to people from Butler and other schools about how to sort of replicate Gonzaga's success. What I think I've found in the 8 years since is I don't think it's that replicable. Like, I think that what they've done is totally unique. I think if you were going to make a run at it, you need, one, the right coach, you know, somebody that's going to buy, you know, your university and city as a major place, regardless of how it's viewed nationally. You know, you need the right resources in place to keep that coach there, whether it's a salary like Mark's salary, the pickleball courts they put in the practice facility. The practice facility itself is amazing. You know, what they've done to the arena, you know, all these things that make Gonzaga like private flights, Nike shoe contract, you know, I mean, it's a legitimately a blue blood level of resources. But then I think you also need something that's really important to the work that Brett Ledbetter and Travis do, and that is a clear vision of what you want to be. You see a lot of college basketball teams that are successful that just get great players. That's not to say they don't have good coaches, but to me, Gonzaga didn't just get great players for this run we just saw. They got great players that fit within their culture and their ethos. And that to me is the most important thing because you saw those early exits before. And they stem in part from like a lack of cohesion that they were trying to create, which is not to disrespect those players, but, you know, just sort of is what it is. And so I think that you have to combine those elements. You need the face in the right place. You need the money to keep them there. And you need a vision that makes you unique, that embraces what's different about you. Like, I think Gonzaga does an amazing job of saying, we're not exactly Duke. We're not exactly North Carolina. We're not exactly Kentucky. Instead, we're something totally different, and that's not only okay, but perhaps advantageous. And I think when you put all that together, you have a situation that I don't think will be replicated.
You mentioned having to find the what and the how. When you're talking about the why, is everything you just mentioned, is that the why that makes Gonzaga special, or is that the why about what you're writing your stories about?
Yeah, to me, the soul of Gonzaga is tradition, and it's a tradition that's passed from guys from your generation all the way down to Chet Holmgren when he comes in. And, you know, we talked about Sunday Ball, we talked about Personal Growth Monday, but I also wrote some in the story that the cover that was not, unfortunately, on the national title game. But I you know, I wrote a lot about how much Mark likes playing pickleball, standing invitation with the guys, like went undefeated in the bubble. Gonzaga to me is a major, major program. Like, let's not get that confused, but I think it has the soul of a mid-major place. And that's not to say it's small or to denigrate Spokane. It is more to say, okay, here is this thing. And their why is like, we're going to do this differently. And that's what's ultimately going to get us beyond what anybody could expect. And if you're going to get beyond reasonable expectation, which they have by any measure, I think that way. This is not about replicating Kentucky. It's about making a new imprint that's so different nobody can copy it. And I think the big step there when you look at this team was the way they evolved their offense. You know, it looked like an NBA team. Like, every college basketball game last year that I watched besides Gonzaga, it's like 60-58. You know, they're shooting like me out on the rec court, and it's just like bruising, kind of plodding basketball. It was a joy to watch the Zags play because of how they played. And I think that stems from Mark and Tommy evolving in a way to take the program to another level. And it just speaks to the same thing. It's growth mindset. It's defining clearly who you are. And it's daring really to be different. And I think you've seen that from them in a way that, to me, makes a lot of narrative sense.
So in the news, everyone's seen now that Tommy Lloyd, our great assistant coach, one of our best recruiters for international players, has gone to Arizona. From someone that sees the big picture, how do you see that impacting Gonzaga?
Yeah, I think there will be an impact. And I should apologize to your listeners because, you know, all my friends who are Zags fans basically say I jinxed them with the cover. And then I wrote about Tommy during the tournament and jinxed them yet again. So I'm very sorry. I'll stay away from Spokane as long as I can. And yeah, I think in some ways you could make the argument that Tommy embodied what Gonzaga did as much or more than Mark, which I think is a kind of a crazy thing to say. I mean to take nothing away from Mark Few when I say that. But when you look at international recruiting, that's Tommy Lloyd. When you look at development, that's both of them. You know, when you look at the soul and the tradition and the I'm going to stay here and make this mine, you know, I think he played a role in that that's significant and close to what Mark did. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that the tradition hasn't been passed on to the other assistants. That doesn't mean that he can't come back whenever Mark steps away. You know, I get the allure of running your own program, to do it in a place with a lot of history, a place where the expectations have dropped in recent seasons, but where you can still get guys to go. I could see why he left, but I think it speaks to what him and Mark had built that he almost didn't, you know, that dragged on for a while, that there was, you know, some hesitancy. And I think they've made that a tough place to leave, which I think speaks to his influence and impact.
Kind of going back to you and as a writer, and you mentioned you might be at the dentist thinking about stories. What do you think your real talent is? Obviously, you're a talented writer. Is it your ability to think, or is it your ability to be an observer?
You know, my wife's in the room over, so she might laugh when I say this, but I think the thing that helps me the most in my job is empathy. I think that I identify with conflict and struggle in a way where I can see a story beyond this person is good at sports or this program might win the title. Like, my goal is to really get into motivation, desire, and what's intrinsic about athletes, the things that we can't really quantify. I have a piece out today, for instance, on Alex Smith, and we know that he broke his leg and that the bone went through his skin, and we know that he came back to play in the NFL. But the stuff that's been done on him so far just doesn't dive deep enough into why on earth would anyone want to do that. And I opened the piece with us sitting at a restaurant in Hawaii and me confessing to him that I can't do anything except stare at his leg, because it was frankly pretty gross. You know, it was like red and bulging and it just looked like a Frankenstein-ish kind of deal. And, you know, to me, the real story with him is what happened to him that allowed him to decide that this was why he wanted to do something. It's not why come back. It's like, why keep getting up? It was a bust as the number one pick. He was replaced by Colin Kaepernick. He was replaced by Patrick Mahomes. And he's traded to Washington. This guy literally climbed out of everything. So then the why is like, this isn't one comeback story. This is a life of comeback stories. And everything that happened to him before is what made him able to come back. But it's also what made him able to step away. It's the exact same thought process and internal sort of motivation that led him back to football and then away from it. And that to me is really, you know, what I'm trying to dig into. Like, I like listening to people. I think, you know, journalists often talk to their subjects. They're often framing questions in a way to elicit an answer that benefits their angle. I don't go into a story with an angle if I can help it. You know, I'm always fighting with my editors about that. I think the story should come from the reporting. I don't want to have an idea of what I'm going to write about you before I talk to you. I want to know what you think. And the story isn't collaborative in the sense where like they have control over it for PR reasons, but it should feel collaborative in terms of like, I really want to know, you know, I'm not in this for a tidy fairy tale. I want to know what really happened. And if I can convey that to people that read our stuff, like that to me is the best way to do my job, to really show them, you know, sort of the real truth involved. But it should come from the people, not from my own head. And so I think by being able to put myself in their position, by being able to ask a lot of questions, by being incredibly fortunate to spend a lot of time with people, talking to them, I'm able to sort of peel back those layers. And sometimes it becomes almost like psychologist. It's like I'm their psychologist the way I talk to mine, you know? And like Michaela Schifrin's a good example. I've written a lot about her in the last couple of years, dominant skier, probably the best ever. And we just have these really incredibly deep conversations. And it just, to me, it leads to a level of nuance and complexity and detail that's exactly what I'm looking for.
That's interesting. So one of the things I wanted to discuss with you is how to ask good questions, how to be able to dig deeper. Even myself as a strength coach, I sit down with an athlete and I want to be able to learn more about them. And sometimes I'm not talented enough to maybe frame the right open-ended question. I get one-word answers. But it sounds to me like maybe it's not the question asking as much as the connection, the being empathetic, the being curious. Is that what you're saying?
100%. And I would say, like, I mean, there's some basic stuff you can do with questions. Like, you know, I try to never ask a question that can be answered yes or no. You know, then if you get a yes or no, you're probably, it's your fault. And I'm a very wordy person, as you can tell in this podcast, excuse me. I try to keep my questions short. You know, when I'm interviewing someone, I'd like to get my question out in 10 seconds or less if I can, because you really just want it to flow, you know, and sometimes you're going to mention things about yourself or your own life in terms of credibility and relating to people. But mostly what I do, like whenever I talk to college classes, I do it 50 times a year. They always say, how long is your question list? And my answer is always the same. I don't go into an interview with a list of questions. I go into it with four ideas of what I might want to talk about. You know, so maybe with Mark Few, it was the program history, dealing with the pressure and expectation of March, how he evolved as a coach, what Jalen did in that evolution. And I just write down a few things on a piece of paper. And then if I'm doing my job right, if I'm having a good day, I should ask 25, 50 follow-ups per thing. It is a level of detail that I hope comes across in my writing. You know, it's not, if you went to the grocery store, I want to know what color was the car. What do you call the car? When did you buy the car? Is there any significance to the car? Who drives the car? Essentially, I have to be able to paint a picture that a television segment can show. And I think that by asking those kind of follow-ups, you get a level of detail and understanding. And I have to even tell people I write about essentially that, hey, I'm going to ask a lot of questions. Tell me when I'm annoying. The detail will make the story. I promise you'll know it at the end. Because it's, I always say, it's kind of goofy, but I'm always like, it's like a good game plan. The detail matters. The level of sort of surgical precision matters. And I think by being transparent with the people I write about, you know, hopefully they come around to being okay with it.
Well, the very best story I think you've ever written is about a Sunday basketball game. Now, I'm a little biased on this one too, but this is how we connected. I was in a hotel in San Antonio for the women's basketball tournament, and you and I connected and we got to chat Sunday hoops. Tell me about the what, the how, the why on that story for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was probably my favorite thing I wrote all tournament. And it was mainly because it is a story that to me explains the program in a way that like people wouldn't understand, you know, if they didn't know it. And that doesn't mean like I was really careful not to tie like the current team and what you guys do on Sundays. Like sometimes they play, they didn't, you know, they don't do it in season, all that kind of stuff. But to me, it's like what we said earlier. Gonzaga is about tradition. It's about a soul of a basketball team. And when you have a Sunday game hosted by a Hall of Fame point guard who sweeps the floor beforehand and has been known to bloody a nose or two. Sorry, Mike. I think that one, that's showing people in and around the area, you know, that there is a way to play basketball that is understood in Spokane. Hoop Fest with the Zags, with the tournament, and, you know, how often it goes there. That I think this is a way to really clearly define that and show it. But to me, it's also a way to show these kids, even if they are not playing in the league or playing on most Sundays, it's a way to show them that the people in the program care about each other, that this is something they want to pass down, not that they feel obligated to, because it worked for them, whether it was like on the rise to something improbable or maintaining it or boosting it. And so, you know, to see Adam Morrison go back, to see Matt Santangelo go back before the knee injury. Sorry, Matt. To see, you know, the guys like Casey Calvary always playing in it. I just think that, you know, Dan Dickow, I think that there is it's almost like a tradition of philosophy. It's like this is Socrates and Marcus Aurelius, you know, sitting around talking about like how life should be lived. And it's done in a way that's demonstrative and practical and real. And to me, when you talk about a soul of a program that is this tradition, that is one way I think that best embodies it.
I love when you talked about the asking the questions really comes from the empathy. That's your skill. And a lot of people want to know how you can get a game going for 15 years, every single Sunday with all these kind of players. And I mentioned about how kind and thoughtful John is, and you can't teach that. Just yesterday, you know, we all know I had heart surgery, He had called me and said, hey, I was doing a little research and there's this standard process, little vitamin type thing. It's called, you know, different vitamins that would be good for your heart. You might want to check into it. And I'm like, my family or friends, they all love me more than anything. They're not researching different natural supplements I could take to, you know, optimize my health. And so I think the Gonzaga is special and he might be at the heart of all of it. You know, have you ever seen a guy that is so talented? He's an NBA Hall of Famer. Do the grunt work or do the little things like John?
No. And in fact, the detail I love the most in the story is that he shows up and sweeps the floor as like part of a warm up. Like, to me, that's selfless. And I think there is a lot of selflessness that goes into the style of Gonzaga basketball. You know, you look at Jalen Suggs, right? Like, comes in as a freshman, could average 25 points a game if he threw up enough shots, you know, and instead he is selflessly fitting into a role that maximized that team. Do I think that John Stockton helped that process? Absolutely. You know, even if it's just by osmosis, by seeing it, you know, by knowing that this guy is around and he was the NBA's best passer ever. And that literally what made him famous was like giving the ball to somebody else. And I think that that comes across in Sunday Ball, but it also comes across in the way that Gonzaga plays. You know, there are people on the team. Cook is a good example, right? Like, he had a couple really big moments this season, and he could have played for almost anybody. And yet there's stretches where you don't see him play for a month, you know, like in any sort of significant way. Like, to me, that's selfless. That is a basketball player that's exactly what they're looking for, and they don't make a run at undefeated if he doesn't have a couple games that I'm thinking of but can't remember in specifically right now. So, yeah, I think that's why it all ties together, and this is why my brain works that way. It is. You know, I'm always drawing connections or trying to. I'm always searching for meaning. And what I loved about writing about Gonzaga so much this year, like, my editors were teasing me that this is my new beat rather than the NFL. And I, by the way, I'd trade it in a heartbeat if it were possible. You know, Jim Meehan maybe wants to swap. But I just think it was cool to dive into something where people were really willing to explain why they did things and how they worked. You know, a guy like Travis Knight, a guy like Jalen Suggs, a guy like Mark Few and Tommy Lloyd. And, you know, it was the kind of access we don't get a lot in the NFL. And I feel like I was really able to dig deeper into things like Sunday Ball, you know, because they were so willing to open up.
Yeah, John's an interesting one because, in my opinion, he is the best point guard ever to play the game. And you talked about servant leadership. He is literally better at serving or assisting players than anyone in the history of the game. No one has ever served or assisted their teammates more than John. I think you're right. Even though he might not directly work with Jalen on a daily basis, I think just having that influence and that lineage has been so crucial for the program.
Yeah, I called him God's point guard in my first draft of that story, but I was told that he probably wouldn't like that description, so he toned it down a little bit. But, you know, to me, it's like, if you were, this is kind of an overused deal, but if you were going to create a point guard from clay, you could do a lot worse than just recreating him.
What is your favorite sports story that you've done? You've been doing this for a lot of years. Is there one that sticks out and why?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I got to admit, I sometimes give different answers here. You know, to me, the most powerful one I've done recently maybe is a good one. A few years ago, I was sitting at home in my townhouse in Seattle, and I get a call from my editor, and he says, there's been a bus crash in Saskatchewan, and I want you to get on a plane today to go and write about it. So I like booked it to SeaTac, flew to Vancouver, popped over to Saskatchewan, got there in the middle of the night, drove 2 hours without seeing another car to this tiny town called Humboldt. Now, this was a bus that had crashed that was carrying a minor league hockey team. These are not potential pros. They're angling for college scholarships in the United States. And they were going to an away playoff game in this incredible season that wasn't supposed to happen. And a truck driver missed the stop sign, hit their bus. There's 30 people on board. 29 were injured and 16 died that day. And so the initial story was kind of a rush, you know, obviously went up to the crash site, met with the mayor, all the kind of stuff you do when you're parachuting into town and trying to do what I would normally take 6 weeks to do and do it in a day and a half. And I was happy with that story. And I thought it was not only compelling, but just sort of really sad to trying to trace how that moment happened and what it meant. You know, subsequently, we decided to go back. And this is where the meaningful part comes in. This is where I am incredibly lucky to do the job that I get to do. So there was one kid on that team named Logan Boulay, and he was a senior forward that shouldn't have been playing at that level. And yet he worked his way to become what they call an assistant captain, you know, second captain, essentially. And he was like a bruising defender, like would fight for his teammates. And he had this guy who trained him in the summer named Sluggo. Now, Sluggo was an insane person. He would have them like pull rocks along the bottom of a swimming pool and like run up hills, run down dirt bike ramps to like work on the like, you know, the sort of balance while they're moving. And Sluggo was a guy who told Logan that he was becoming an organ donor. And then he died while driving his daughter to swim practice unexpectedly before this season that the bus crashed, you know, and he just happened to tell Logan that this had been a thing. So Logan, on his 21st birthday, in honor of the trainer that had helped him, became an organ donor. And more importantly than that, he told his host family in Humboldt, Saskatchewan, that he had made this decision. So when he died in that crash, and his parents, I'm getting a little emotional talking about it, and his parents, you know, are sitting at his bedside, like writing things on hospital bracelets and lining them up his arms and realizing that, they're going to lose their child. He's 21 years old. And the kid that lived with the family says to them that he wanted to be an organ donor. And because his family pushed the doctors to follow through on that, and because Logan had made this decision, and because of his coach, and because of this team, and because of the way that sports work in the grand scheme of life, became a new story in the aftermath of the crash. And between the piece we wrote and the other stories, Canada, a place with a terrible dearth of organ donation, got 250,000 new donors. And when you think about Logan's life and the six people he saved with his own organs, but then the hundreds of thousands of people that will benefit from the people that came to become donors. Like it's kind of overwhelming to think about it.
That's such a beautiful story. I had a great experience this past weekend. I was in Seattle. My high school coach has passed away. And I was just doing a lot of reflecting because at the funeral, we talked so much about what a great person, family member, the friend, all the great he did in the community. But you couldn't take that away from all the basketball and the good he did on the court. And all of it is kind of tied together. Like we touched on with the Gonzaga program, it's not one thing. And you could see how the beauty of sport and having this trainer make a huge impact on him led to all these other beautiful acts. And so that's got to be part of the fun part of your job, is to be able to see how all these stories are just linked together.
100%. Like to me, that's sports. And I'm always just shocked, like how much everything connects, you know. Ricky Williams is tied with Alex Smith, you know, those two guys that I, you know, talked about recently. But who would have thought that I would, you know, one of the most meaningful stories of my life would be told from Humboldt, Saskatchewan. It's literally the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. And I've had other really meaningful ones. The Helinski family, when their son committed, you know, died by suicide. You know, I've written a ton about them and their impact on my life. You know, I've been to Native American reservations in Acoma. I've been to a place where they go grow grass in Bingley, England, to write about, you know, how you get the Wimbledon grass ready. I've been to the longest match in professional tennis history, like all the close Super Bowls. There is just an emotion and a level of resonance and a level of depth to sports that I think, you know, that's ultimately what makes it unique.
With all these stories, all these coaches, all these players, are there common threads or common themes that you see that make people successful?
That's a great question. I would say some of them are like the more obvious ones. You know, I've written a lot about Tom Brady. I think I was the first person to write about how much he loves avocado ice cream. So I always tease him that he owes me royalties for the packs he's selling now. But, you know, I think that with the truly elite athletes I've talked to, the Roger Federers, the Manny Pacquiao's, the Tom Brady's, the Aaron Rodgers, you know, I think there's a level of obsession involved that sort of borders on unhealthy. And I think that they're able to do that, like normal humans, like regular mortal people like myself are not able to do, is walk right up to that line, but not cross it. And it's a different line for everybody. Like Tom Brady's level of obsession is totally insane. But as long as he doesn't tip into the point where you're, you know, doing things you shouldn't be doing, or stretching your moral and ethical boundaries, or, you know, getting hurt because you're overtraining. Like, you know, I think that there's a different level. What I've noticed is that they're all very much like, I think the 76ers are always given credit for like trust the process, but to me, really great athletes should be given the credit for that term, because I've never met an athlete that doesn't have a process, you know, that hasn't thought through how they will approach their craft, and they all do it differently. You know, like Manny Pacquiao gets hit in the stomach with bamboo sticks, you know, Roger Federer learned ballet, you know, when he was growing up, which is why he moves the way he does. You know, Brady chooses to eat like a person that doesn't enjoy food. But I think they all in some way have sort of examined how they will go about it. And then it's a matter of like, once you have a process that works for you, once you've committed to doing it, once you define your vision and goals, then I think they're similar to anybody in an industry that does well. Because at that point, when you have a clear plan, when you have the idea and motivation of what's going to get you there, then it's just work, you know, then you just got to outwork people. And that's my business, your business, anybody's business. And so I just think that there's something that's a little off with all of them, the really great ones that like just the level of, you know, why is John Stockton still playing basketball every Sunday, you know, getting mad and after Brooks kicks the ball and like wanting to leave the gym. Like, I mean, it's because like that's him, you know, truly him deep down in his soul. At least that's the way it seems to me.
It seems like getting to the success, the road that takes is different than actually what you have to do when you get there. We see so many athletes that make it to the top of their game, the top of their field, and then different parts of their life falls apart. They're not able to stay there. What have you seen in the successful athletes that are able to maintain, like from the outside, someone like a Tom Brady? What are they doing differently, or what do they know that other athletes don't know?
Yeah, see, that's the cool thing about what I just described is that it's transferable. You know, this isn't like a roadmap that gets you to success. It's a roadmap that keeps you there. You know, that gives you, you know, I cover the NFL mostly. All any NFL team wants is a chance to win every year. So you see all these teams that have potentials of dynasties, and every year there's going to be injuries or COVID or whatever happens in the world. And, you know, you want to be set up like the Chiefs are right now to legitimately have a chance every year. And so, you know, these athletes that I'm talking about, I think what they do is it is similar to what Mark Few talks about. It is growth mindset. It's being able to take what got you to a place and realize it can't be replicated exactly, but that if you remain grounded in process, if you stay with what, you know, sort of the soul of what got you there, if you're constantly refining what you're doing, like Mark and Tommy, like we talked about evolving the offense, like that to me speaks to like living a growth mindset rather than just talking about it. And so, you know, when I see somebody like Brady go, last year before the season, I picked the Chiefs and the Bucks to go to the Super Bowl. And it's because I've seen people bet against Tom Brady for 10 years. And one year they'll actually be right, but it's not going to be this one. And so, you know, I think what he's done is like changed his process as he got older to make sure it's more relevant to him each season. But what we saw in the Super Bowl was him zipping throws that a 43-year-old just should not be able to make. You know, I'm 41 years old. I can barely get out of bed without a sore neck. And so it's everything he did from 06 to winning 8 million Super Bowls that allowed him to win his seventh. And I think it's everything that Alex Smith did to get back to football that led him to decide he wanted to step away. And it's, to me, it's everything Mark did that put them in position to make history. And they're going to build on it and keep the ethos of that as they make another run at it next season.
I'm so lucky that I get to be in an environment, not just with our basketball teams, but all our sport teams. You know, I get to see baseball and volleyball and golf, tennis, all these great coaches and players put work in. As an observer, as someone that wants to be able to benefit from that, what should I be looking for? You know, how can I get the most out of being in this environment so it's a positive impact on my life?
Yeah, it's a great question. I love that question. That's maybe the one I've never gotten before. You know, my instinct there is to, I just think it's cool that you're able to meet with so many elite people. Like, that's one thing I love about my job. You know, I am able to be around people that have figured out life in a way that I never would be able to. And I'm able to draw on the things that they do as part of my own life, you know. And so, you know, Travis Knight, I know I brought him up a couple of times on here, but he has been an amazing sounding board for me in terms of writing about Gonzaga. But, you know, we've also talked about my own processes and how I come to arrive at stories and some of the things we talked about on here. And I think what I'm really incredibly fortunate to have is to be able to draw on that sort of wisdom from different places. And so, you know, you probably don't have as many coaches at Gonzaga that are as famous as Mark Few, but they've all been dedicated their entire lives to sports. And if you put them all together, you'd have like a pretty amazing coach. And so, you know, when I always talk to other writers, like it's less like reading a bunch of stories. It's more like looking at the structure, the soul, the foundation, you know, how was it built? Who did they talk to? And then reaching out to those writers, like what compelled you to do the story? You know, I'm always bugging people that write great stuff because I just want to see like, how did you get him to talk? You know, what did you say? I spent half my life now. I didn't do this to the New York Times, like pitching myself. Like, these are the kinds of stories I do. This is my process. I know I'm annoying, but just trust me, it'll be worth your time. And then you got to make good on it. But, you know, the whole point, I think, is to continuously be looking, searching, examining, changing, so that ultimately I arrive at a process now that I didn't have any idea of 10 years ago. And it's because of all those little pieces that I've drawn from all these different places that I'm able to, you know, live a less stressful existence.
Well, I can speak to it firsthand. It was so fun being able to connect with you. You made me feel so comfortable. You asked the right questions. You gave the right responses. So obviously you're talented at what you do and your work speaks for itself. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show and being so generous with your time. Where can our listeners find out more about you?
You know, SI.com is always a good place to find my stuff. Magazine issues, next issue with Alexson, it's out next week. And then, I just did a book with Jim Gray, Talking to Goats. If anybody wants to check it out, available at Amazon, all that kind of stuff. So, and I'm working on a book right now about Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He's the Chiefs guard who stepped away from the 2020 season to be a doctor and fight COVID on the front lines.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, hopefully you get to come up to Spokane one day and be able to sit down and continue this conversation. And once again, man, just so great seeing you.
I would love that, Mike. Tell Mark Few that I'm coming for him with my pickleball paddle. I'm ready.
Oh, don't worry. He'll be ready. He was practicing yesterday for you.
Thanks for having me, Mike. That was awesome.
Now that's a wrap on episode 83. And I hope you join me next week where I get to connect with my longtime friend and Boise State men's basketball coach, RJ Barsh. In addition to being a great coach, he's more importantly an impactful mentor to young men. We worked a basketball camp together 20 years ago in Italy, and I got to see firsthand his huge heart for people. If you want to see what the highest level of loving and serving athletes looks like in a college setting, you won't want to miss this episode. And to all of you who are committed, well, earn your X.